Hello and welcome to the 538 Politics Podcast. My name is Galen Druk, and we've got a big show for you tonight. There are four candidates with a real shot at winning the Democratic nomination, according to 538's forecast. So we're going to debate the electoral paths of each of those candidates. We're also going to weigh in on a controversial conversation at the center of the Democratic primary at the moment, and that's, are Americans biased against voting for a woman for president? We're also going to play a game that tests how well we know what Americans actually think. And as listeners at home may have been able to tell, we are not recording this podcast from our regular studio this evening. We are in front of a live audience at 6th and I in Washington, D.C. Wow. Love that energy. D.C. is lit. And here with me, of course, is our fabulous panel, Editor-in-Chief Nate Silver. Senior politics writer Claire Malone.
Hey, Galen.
And managing editor Micah Cohen. And also, of course, here with us, the most important part, as listeners at home can hear, is our live audience. So give yourselves a round of applause. Thanks for coming out tonight. And we're going to start things off with a little debate. According to our recently published forecast, the four candidates with a clear shot at winning the Democratic nomination are Joe Biden, Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, and Pete Buttigieg. In that order. And we're going to debate the electoral cases for and against each of those candidates winning. Now, we've been assigned positions in advance, so two of us will debate each other, then the other two will ask questions, and then all of you, the audience, are going to get to decide who wins.
How much time do we get?
You get 1 minute to make your argument. Wow. You get 1 minute for to make your counter-argument. We'll ask a couple questions. Are we ready?
Sure.
Yeah? Ready to play your part, audience? And you are, let's be clear, you are deciding based on the quality of the argument, not just based on who you like better.
I'm sure that'll work.
Okay, so up first, we have Nate and Claire debating. And Claire is going to make the argument for Biden. Nate is going to make the argument against Biden. Take it away, Claire.
Okay. Joe Biden is, this is a candidate that can win a general election. That's all I kind of need to say. If you are going for a candidate who can win the Democratic primary, he can do that. Probably a couple other people can. But Joe Biden is the one person who has crossover appeal in the six or so swing states that you need to win a general election. Joe Biden, by the way he talks, in a kind of like not very woke way, innately appeals to the kind of white male voters that Democrats need to win back or win over. And none of the other candidates have that. Sanders has it perhaps in his self-presentation and the identity politics of like working class people, but his politics scare certain people and you're just gonna not get any further with him. Elizabeth Warren is not gonna win the general election because she's a woman. I think I have that later. And Joe Biden has the kind of steady at the till. I was Barack Obama's vice president. He wins over huge constituencies in minority voters, black voters in particular, that the Democrats need to win. It's a pretty open and shut case. He's been the sustained leader in the polls throughout the primary. And I think his durability kind of speaks for itself. I believe my minute is up.
All right.
Cutting myself off like Joe Biden.
So, Claire, you're weighing heavily electability for Biden, which no doubt is a fairly large part of his appeal. But here's what I worry about if I'm Team Biden. I worry about a four-letter state beginning with an I, ending with an A, where I might finish anywhere from first, in which case we'll both admit he's in good shape, to fourth, in which case he might not be. If Biden finishes behind the two progressives and, say, Mayor Pete in Iowa, his electability halo, his bubble begins to burst a little bit, would not look so good. Another problem potentially is that you could have the vote consolidate, where right now you have some votes for Sanders, some votes for Warren, together they actually have more of the vote than Biden. If one of them does well, the other eventually concedes and drops out, endorses the other one, all of a sudden that progressive vote could overtake the Biden vote. So I worry also about his ground game, where you have in Iowa, you're going to have very enthusiastic support for Bernie, who has been there before, for Warren and Buttigieg, who have invested a lot of money in the state. The rules of the caucus are fairly complicated, and if I had to bet on one candidate to underperform on caucus night, it might be Biden. And so, you know, I think he's not going to go bust, but I can see him running out of steam, starting in Iowa, and then the progressive kind of wing of the party unifying and overtaking him.
All right. Do you have any rebuttals to make?
I mean, no ground game. I don't know, man. Like, that's kind of a specious claim, right? This guy has a lot of money. He might not get as much word-of-mouth pickup as, like, a Sanders or a Warren does, but you better believe that he's got a lot of people out there saying, I'm your precinct captain. Are you coming to vote to caucus for Biden? Hell yeah. He's also probably going to win over a lot of those Sanders people in a second round, right? You could see a lot of things changing in the caucus room.
I just think the fact that Bernie in particular has been in Iowa before, and like literally he has people who have been through the dynamics of the caucus, which is a very odd process in some ways. I have to think that would help a fair bit. And the fact that, look, it takes some endurance to caucus, right? Bernie's voters are young. They'll walk over broken glass for him potentially. I don't know. I mean, I would just say, like,
are you implying that the Biden voters will have to go to bed early?
They are older. I'm just saying, like, Florida's a good Biden state or something, right? But, like, but Iowa, I don't know. If it's snowy, yeah.
You could also say they have experience caucusing, and these young people have never done it before, easily confused.
All right,
it's the revenge of OK Boomer.
So, I think we've sussed out the arguments a little bit. So, who thinks that Claire won with the case for Joe Biden winning the Democratic nomination? All right. Who thinks that Nate won with the case against Joe Biden winning the nomination? Honestly, that's pretty close.
No, Claire
won.
Are
we adjusting for the presumed preferences of the audience in terms of...
I don't know, have you polled them?
Yeah.
All right, Micah, who do you think won that one based on the audience applause?
Claire clearly won. Also, Biden's the favorite in our forecast, so...
Yeah, it's a little harder.
Next up, in the national polling and on our forecast, is Sanders. So I'm going to be making the case, the electoral case for Sanders winning the Democratic nomination. Micah, you're going to be making the case against. So as we've noted, Sanders is behind Biden in our forecast and also in the national polls. But fortunately for Sanders, our primary system is complex and sequential in America. And if you look at the first three states, Iowa, New Hampshire, and Nevada, Sanders is basically tied with Biden in the polling in all three of those states. On top of being tied, he has a lot of money, and he has a massive organization with a lot of energy. And so when we're looking particularly at caucus states like Iowa and Nevada, he has an advantage over Biden in those states. And I think at this point we can say that if he were to win Iowa based on the ground game advantages that he has, the organizing advantages that he has, and the money he has there, that will give him enough of a boost to win New Hampshire. Then it's pretty clear that if he were to win Iowa and New Hampshire, he'd have that electability halo around him. He could take that win to Nevada. And even if he lost South Carolina, he'd have a clear path to the nomination. Now, as far as establishment Democrats who may not like him are concerned, I think that once he wins those first three states, they'll see the writing on the wall and they'll prioritize beating Trump over Sanders not winning the nomination, and they will fall in line behind him in order to win in 2020. And that is how Sanders wins the Democratic nomination.
Galen, I was laughing because the thought occurred to me that this is just like being at a party in Brooklyn. Someone just like monologuing for 2 minutes.
Somebody's
about
made this argument to you before? God, our lives are terrible, aren't they? All right, Micah. The case against Sanders.
Where to begin?
Ooh.
Okay, so I'm going to play this up a little bit. So one, looked at in a vacuum, all those numbers you cited, Galen, look okay. He's tied in these early states, but we don't have to look at it in a vacuum. Bernie Sanders had everything set up for him in 2020 to really be where Biden is, to be the front runner. What has he done with it? Not really that much. He's mostly a factional candidate. And that, I think, is the biggest argument against Sanders, is he has yet to prove that he's not a factional candidate. Can he win over non-white voters? Maybe. He has yet to show that. The other big knock against Sanders is you glossed over it, Galen, but let's say Sanders does win Iowa. Let's say he follows that up with a win in New Hampshire. I think you would see the Democratic Party apparatus move wholesale to stop him. I don't think you can lump him in with Warren in just this progressive lane. I think the socialism word would represent a ton of problems for red state senators, Democratic senators running for re-election. And I think Democratic elites essentially would mobilize to get in his way. So it's just really hard to see, given everything, how he doesn't kind of have just a rerun of 2016.
I think you deny history to suggest that a factional candidate cannot win a presidential nomination. We saw it as recently as 2016, and we saw it in the Democratic Party throughout the 70s with Carter and McGovern.
So, Micah, what is the actual hard evidence that Bernie has a ceiling?
So I think the evidence is sort of the absence of evidence. It's basically what I said at the beginning, which stay with me for a second here. Don't think about it too hard. I think it's that Bernie Sanders is not Pete Buttigieg. He has a national profile. People know who he is. They know who he stands for. They know what he stands for. And where is he?
It's like Trump. He has a known brand.
He has a known brand. And he's still at 15, 20% in the polls. So, like, you know, I think he's had an opportunity. Warren hasn't had. Buttigieg hasn't had. And he hasn't done anything with it.
When it comes to a ceiling, he won 43% of the Democratic vote in 2016. So in a field as wide as we're talking about, that kind of support could win him the nomination. He also clearly has expanded his appeal amongst voters of color. And so I don't think we're looking at the same very white coalition that we were looking at in 2016.
Bernie Sanders was basically the other option in 2016. I think he picked up a lot of the vote that just for whatever reason, including gendered reasons, people didn't want to vote for Clinton. So I don't think that 40... I mean, if this campaign had started and Sanders was at, forget what he got in 2016, even close to that, if he was at 35%, I think we would take him a lot more seriously. But he's not. He's still, you know, 15, 20%. He's got a ways to go.
All right, we got to move on. So, audience, me with the case for Sanders. Ooh.
I'm clapping for Galen.
I voted for you. You're supposed to...
Mike, I'm here to break up the establishment ways of doing things.
And with Micah, the case against Sanders.
I think this is where we should
Hold on. Am I really that bad of a debater?
No, I think this is where we should take into account the demographics of our audience in Washington, D.C.
Wow, the establishment really packed the house tonight. All right.
Wait a second. I get credit for those debating skills. I'm taking that.
Next up, we have Elizabeth Warren. The case for Warren is Micah. The case against Warren is Claire.
Oh, my gosh.
Micah, take it away.
Okay. Number one, candidate broadly acceptable to the party. Can be a unity candidate, unite the different wings of the party. Number two, she has been incredibly resilient in this campaign. It's easy to forget, but she started out, and I think a lot of people had written her off. She was low single digits in the polls, being insulted by President Trump. It kind of seemed like she was going nowhere, spends weeks and weeks building her support in the polls. She has seen a dip recently, but I think what's really telling to me is it's not the boom and bust cycle we saw with Harris, for example, or that we saw with like Herman Cain in 2012 or Rick Perry in 2012 or like five other candidates in 2012. This is the deep cut audience. So that's telling to me. That one suggests to me that she has a real loyal following that isn't just kind of moving this way and that with whether there's favorable coverage. And two, her support is almost more valuable in a way right now because she has gone through multiple negative news cycles. You know, Bernie Sanders has not really. He hasn't had his moment kind of under the gun. Among all the people in this giant field, I think it's easiest to imagine Warren winning Iowa, winning New Hampshire, and then the party kind of rallying behind her, as opposed to, in the case of Sanders, sort of rallying against her. The other thing, final thing is, I actually think Iowa could be setting up perfectly for Warren right now, in the sense that this recent dip in the polls is coming with enough time for her to correct for it, but maybe not quite enough time. This is speculative.
Arguably.
This part, unlike the rest of this, is speculative. But she could win Iowa basically in the perfect circumstance. Like Nate's research and the forecast shows that the... Oh, please.
I took a minute. I watched
pot,
the pot.
Kettle, you know.
I watched the pot.
No. Final point is, you get a bigger bounce coming out of Iowa, the kind of lower the expectations are for you. Expectations measured as kind of how you're doing in the national polls. So Warren could, if she wins Iowa, get a big bounce, a bigger bounce than Sanders, bigger bounce than Biden. Done.
All right, Micah. I don't need 3 minutes. I need one. I will not deny you that Elizabeth Warren is a very popular candidate within the Democratic Party.
Thank you.
Good for Elizabeth Warren. But you know what? Elizabeth Warren, as you can see very helpfully on the forecast screen, is in third place right now. And while she's popular among Democrats, she's not very popular at all among non-Democrats or the general election electorate.
We're talking about the Democratic primary.
But hold on here, Micah. Democrats in the Democratic primary have consistently, since last year, said that the most important quality to them above all things, above voting for someone who shares their ideology, is voting for someone who can beat Trump. You know what? That ain't Elizabeth Warren. And so I think Iowa voters are not, first of all, I don't think she's going to win Iowa. I think it's going to be Sanders or Biden. She's not going to get the bump, and she's not going to, when she runs into Joe Biden's Super Tuesday smash, she's going to plummet in the polls. There's just no way. And yes, it's because of sexism. We can talk about electability stuff later, but no way, Jose. Elizabeth Warren is not winning the Democratic primary.
Do you know? You notice how we've...
1 minute.
We've all... As this has gone on, for some reason, we've all become much more vehement in our arguments.
I mean, Claire, what about the fact that Hillary Clinton...
You got to use your microphone.
Hello? Okay. Claire, what about the fact that Hillary Rodham Clinton, a woman, won...
Guys, we gotta see. Nate took a lot of Mucinex before the show tonight.
If you've heard the podcast, you've heard me recover from this chest cold. But yeah, there was a bit of Mucinex. But Hillary won in 2016, right? And in some ways, Warren is more unifying than Clinton. So how could Clinton win when Warren couldn't?
How could Clinton win when Warren didn't? Well, there was no Joe Biden in the race, and there are more candidates in this race, right? So Joe Biden is sucking up all the electability support, the establishment party support that Hillary Clinton got. I mean, I think in a different... Maybe Warren would have done very well in 2016, right? I think that's quite possible. But also, I just don't think it's not the right... There's too many people competing in this, and Joe Biden is therefore the winner by default.
Also, to Claire's earlier point, Warren is running after Clinton lost the general election.
Wait, you're supposed to be making the case for Warren.
So I think we know who's winning.
My argument is just so strong, I can afford to concede certain points.
Would you like to rebut her argument at all? Instead of buttress?
What was your argument?
I think your argument basically amounted to, I don't think Warren will win Iowa, but she's right there. These are our overall odds. If you look at our odds in Iowa, it's Nate, you have them memorized, right?
No, it's like Biden 30%, Sanders 30%, Warren 22% or something, right? It's pretty close. And by the way, one thing for Warren is like, with the reallocation process in the caucus, we actually have to go line up in groups. Your second choices matter a lot, and she is a lot of voters' second choice, right? So she may benefit if Mayor Pete drops.
She's not guaranteed to get a Mayor Pete voters necessarily. You could also easily see those people swinging over to Biden.
Maybe, but demographically they're more similar potentially, the Warren voters and the Pete voters. Klobuchar voters, which are a group that will realign often, could be a pretty big pickup potentially for Warren.
They'll go to Biden. Okay.
All right.
But no, if you look at
we're gonna cut off debate here, audience, with the case for Warren. Micah. And Claire with the case against Warren.
Adjusting for Claire inflation, I won that one.
And finally, we have Pete Buttigieg arguing the case for Pete Buttigieg. We have Nate arguing the case against Pete Buttigieg. It will be me. Go ahead, Nate.
Three words. Iowa, Iowa, Iowa.
Everyone needs an editor.
He is a very plausible winner in Iowa, basically in a four-way tie for first. Like Warren, he also benefits from second choices in Iowa. He could be, for example, Klobuchar voters, second choice in Iowa in a lot of precincts potentially. If he wins Iowa, my research shows that he is a type of candidate who would get a very large bounce because he is still fairly obscure nationally. He only has like 2/3 name recognition nationally among voters who do know him. His favorables are just fine. They're as good as any other big four. It would be a historic candidacy. I think you can't quite compare it to like Obama, but a gay candidate winning the Iowa caucus would be a pretty big deal. And perceptions about electability might change for him too. I mean, he is a pretty big unknown. He is the mayor of South Bend, Indiana. But once you win the Iowa caucus, that kind of becomes a credential unto itself. You begin to look like a winner. He is kind of well aligned with where the party is overall, kind of a compromise between the progressive wing and the moderate wing. He actually has fairly progressive policies. They're not as progressive as Bernie, for example. Look, we all can see that if he doesn't win Iowa, he is in pretty bad shape. But he can get that big bounce and look, a 1 in 12 chance, right? To me, if he's 1 in 4 in Iowa, he probably should be around, 1 in 4 for the nomination and not 1 in 12.
So, after making an argument advocate, against Nate, the model that you spent months creating, I think I take you at your word that Buttigieg has to win Iowa in order to win the nomination, and I don't think there's good reason to believe that he will win Iowa. While he was doing better in the polls in Iowa earlier this year, he's been on a downward trajectory ever since. And given what we expect the news cycle to be over the next 2.5 weeks on impeachment and maybe a conflict between Warren and Sanders, don't think there's a lot of room for Buttigieg to work his way back into the top of the news cycle. I think unlike almost any other candidate in the top four, he could win Iowa and New Hampshire and still not actually win the nomination. He does so poorly with voters of color that Nevada, South Carolina, and much of the Super Tuesday states, you don't really see going for him unless he can totally change his coalition, which, can you do that in a month? I think that's questionable. I think on top of that, if he were to win Iowa, and then maybe you could argue that with that bounce, he would win New Hampshire, then we'd really see a new cycle of scrutiny looking at his experience and lack of electoral prowess. He won the mayor's election in South Bend with 8,500 votes. He lost the statewide treasurer's election in Indiana. He lost the DNC chair election. And I don't really see, after a news cycle like that, him coming back to...
I tell you what, I'm...
Him coming back to beat a Biden or a Sanders in Nevada, to beat Biden in South Carolina, and to beat, you know, all of those plus Bloomberg in the Super Tuesday states. I rest my case.
Bloomberg.
Wow.
Tell you what, I'm from East Lansing, Michigan, which sounds a lot like South Bend, Indiana. I would think the mayor of East Lansing would be qualified to be president. No, probably not. But
not an electoral argument.
Is it a problem that he has only 3% of the black vote right now? Yeah, probably. But a couple of things. First of all, no candidate apart from Biden is doing that well among African Americans or is necessarily that natural a fit among African-Americans. I mean, Bernie has definitely made inroads, and to some extent Warren, but African-American Democratic primary voters are actually more moderate than Bernie Sanders and Warren are. And if we look, we're assuming that, like, Biden somewhere along the line has exited because Pete Rose, he won the moderate lane, right? I wouldn't hate Pete's chances to get a decent share of the black vote against Warren. And he doesn't have to win every state. He's not going to win every state, right? He has to win kind of the North, and someone else wins the South, right? And so, you know, to me, it's like you can draw a plausible map where he wins enough states to win the nomination.
All right, I think we'll leave it there. I think I've said enough.
Wow.
All right, the case for Pete Buttigieg from Nate. And the case against Pete Buttigieg from yours truly. For the win. I mean, I needed that W after my first performance.
Okay. How many people in this room are currently planning to support Buttigieg? Please clap. I think what we learned is that it's hard for the audience to separate their candidate preferences from the vote.
How many of you are Warren supporters?
I see what you did there, Claire.
No, but, you know, we've got your numbers. We just want you to know.
Okay, let's move on and talk about everybody's favorite topic, electability. But first, today's podcast is brought to you by Calm. They say it takes 2 months to form a habit, and if you're making a resolution this year, that can feel like a long time to wait to see results. With Calm, all it takes is 5 minutes a day to feel better, calmer, and ready to face whatever this year throws at you. Calm is the number one app for sleep, relaxation, and meditation. Calm has sleep stories, which are like bedtime stories for adults. They can help you fall into a deep, natural sleep in minutes. They also have soothing music from artists like Sam Smith, guided meditations, breathing exercises, and so much more to help you relax and de-stress. Over 60 million people use Calm. Join them today to accomplish your goals tomorrow. For listeners of the show, Calm is offering a special limited-time promotion of 40% off a Calm Premium subscription at calm.com/538, the numbers, not the letters. That's 40% off unlimited access to Calm's entire library, and new content is added every week. Get started today at calm.com/538.
Great diction.
I am fully literate. I can read.
No, but Calm.
Now here's the case against
calm.com. Calm is hard to say.
It was. Thank you for appreciating that, Claire. All right. If you've been paying attention to the news over the past week, you know that the non-aggression pact between Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren has fallen apart. Sanders' campaign accused Warren of being a candidate of the elite in campaign talking points. Then someone, seemingly the Warren campaign, leaked to CNN that Sanders told her in a meeting a year ago that he didn't think a woman could win against Trump in 2020. Sanders denies saying that. Warren says he did. As a result, the electability of a woman to the presidency became a topic at the Democratic debate on Tuesday. And on our podcast after the debate, we talked a little about the concept of electability. We're going to expand on it now. It was late. We were tired. We didn't have too much time. It's also been a big topic for Democrats this primary, as Claire mentioned previously, with more voters than in the past saying that they would choose a candidate who could beat Trump over a candidate whose ideology they agree with. So to get us started here, Claire, what do we mean when we talk about electability?
So I think, you know, one of the things that Nate and I had a disagreement about on Tuesday, was that I think that electability has taken on a particular meaning during this election cycle that is perhaps different from what statisticians or data journalists would say is the by-the-book definition. And I think the 2020 definition of electability has become shorthand for who can beat Trump, who can win states in the, frankly, the upper Midwest is kind of like the, I think, the example, the glib example at the top of people's minds. There are obviously other swing states. And those states are filled with white voters, male voters, who Democrats see as being necessary to win the election in 2020. And so inevitably, the term electability means who is electable to those people? Who do those people favor? And so I think Nate was right in saying it's kind of a bad term. And it is kind of a bad term because it prevents people when we're writing about it or when we're talking about it from saying what we really mean, which is, you know, we should probably be more plain spoken when we say, instead of saying like Kamala Harris or Elizabeth Warren has an electability problem, we should figure out ways, sort of rote ways for news organizations to say traditionally, like, you know, some shorthand way of saying traditionally women have had problems with you know, whatever, sexism or some way to sort of convey what we actually mean when we say electability problem.
Well, and even better is something we've tried to do, and this is really following advice from one of our writers, Perry Bacon Jr., is phrase things in terms of the voters, not the candidates. Right. So in other words, there are not really questions about Warren's electability. There are questions about whether voters are too sexist to vote for a woman, right? I don't even mean that in like a... I think that's a more accurate way to describe what's really going on. The other thing is, at the risk of monologuing again, I was listening to the podcast where you guys were disagreeing, not the part where you guys were taking shots at me, the part... But I do think kind of both your definitions of electability are right in a way, where I think we have like real-world electability. Some candidates just in the real world are will have an advantage over another candidate in the general election. Now, how we measure that is kind of the problem, right? And how much uncertainty there is around that. But anyway, there's real-world electability. Then there's like perceived electability, right? So who do people think has the advantage, and how much does that match the real-world electability? But then I think the point you were making, Claire, which I totally agree with, is like there's this third level of it, which is like even that real-world electability is a construction, requires everybody to kind of behave that way.
I think the most substantive point of our disagreement was Nate saying, we have lots of data on women in elections. Women are actually perfectly electable. And I guess my pushback is about presidential elections in particular, which I think are a different beast, and obviously we don't have as much data. But I think common sense and observation can tell us that voters think differently about the presidency perhaps than other elections, that it does make a difference voting for a woman for president versus voting for a woman for Congress, in part because they feel the stakes are higher, because perhaps of the political environment we're in right now. I just think that to me, that was the most substantive part of our disagreement.
So, okay, a couple things here. First of all, I would say one reason why common sense is often misleading is because it fixates too much on the most recent and available examples, right? And so perceptions of electability were very different pre-Hillary Clinton. And examining Hillary Clinton's case, it's like actually fairly ambiguous. I mean, she did win the popular vote. She performed about as well or better as you would expect based on the quote-unquote fundamentals. She had certain kinds of baggage, if you want to call it, that were emails. I actually think the coverage of that was in some ways affected by her gender in an indirect way. But I know, I'm going to steal this. If you guys listen to like the Vox, the Weeds podcast, I'm going to steal this conversation from them. But so the question is not whether women face barriers as candidates, but whether the barriers outweigh potential advantage they might have as well, right? One advantage being that in the primary electorate, the majority of Democratic voters are women, about 60%. That can trigger more enthusiasm. Hillary Clinton leaned heavily into the fact that she would be breaking the glass ceiling, right? And that can have advantages as well. So Obama, for example, got a heavy African-American turnout that Hillary Clinton very much could have used, for example. I think most research would show that for Obama, the racial discrimination against black candidates outweighed that, and he had to be very, very skilled to overcome that. But it does cut both ways a little bit, potentially.
Yeah, I mean, I think, and to make that, you know, the pros of being a woman in an election sense, I mean, I think we're probably going to talk about this a lot as the general election rolls around, but I actually do think that women are going to be really big swing voters. And like, you know, let's say white women in particular, who got a lot of, I think, flack from like Democrats for not voting for a woman in 2016. I actually think you saw a little bit of movement. I know that you saw a little bit of movement among white women in the 2018 midterms towards Democrats. You could say like it could be to the Democrats' advantage to have a woman nominee in the general. But I also go back to Hillary Clinton won the popular vote, not the Electoral College, and it's kind of the same thing. It's like it's all well and good to run up the tabulation in certain places, but you have to think a little bit targeted about the kind of voters who are in certain states and who are up for grabs.
Nate, what can we say objectively? I know that data is limited, and so we shouldn't draw broad conclusions about electability, but what can we say about what makes somebody electable or not electable?
So first of all, one thing is that you have a filtering process in the primary, right? Where if you survive the primary, that requires a lot of skills that correlate with skills you need to win the general election as well. Building a coalition, raising money, performing well in debates, so on and so forth, right? Having some stamina. It's a very long process, the primaries, right? So one answer might be that you worry about electability in case where you're picking a candidate by fiat, but that the filter of the primary would absolve some of those concerns, right? With that said, you know, you do have to expand the data to races for Congress or governor. That's when you do get like a decent sample size, and there are some things that come through in that data, one of which is that, yes, in general, other things being equal, that candidates who are more moderate tend to win a bit more often. Candidates who are more experienced tend to win a bit more often. Candidates who won their previous races by bigger margins tend to get reelected by bigger margins, controlling other factors, constant, right? Raising more money tends to be a positive indicator, especially if it comes from actual voters and not from yourself, like Bloomberg or something, right? So you kind of could put together like an electability matrix sort of, right? And say, okay, here are like four or five different empirically relevant electability indicators and see kind of which candidates come out scoring higher or lower on those indicators. And are there some candidates who consistently do well or poorly? I'm not sure there really are this year, you know. By some definitions, you'd say, okay, well, Bernie, he's way too far to the left, and that would be a big problem, right? On the other hand, Bernie clearly has a lot of people power behind him. His actual electoral case is sort of interesting in that he, like, Vermont didn't used to be a super blue state. It used to be kind of a purple state, right? He did beat a Republican incumbent in 1990. He has actually an interesting case.
Let me just point to one thing. So the chart behind us on stage for listeners at home as well is Gallup data based on, you know, Americans self-reporting who they would be willing to vote for. And as you see on here, fewer Americans say they would be willing to support somebody who identifies as a socialist, for example, than as a woman. But we see a lot more conversation about Warren's electability or woman's electability than we see about Sanders' electability based on being a socialist. And now I know also, Nate, that based on the data you're talking about in state and Senate, House elections, governor's elections, when women run, they do as well as men do. Do we think that this all gets kind of mixed up when we're talking about president versus those lower races?
I mean, I do.
Yeah, I definitely do. I mean, I take Nate's point about, like, common sense is often wrong, but I think common sense suggests there are, like, very particular gendered ideas in the American public about the presidency that just aren't there for other offices, right? There's the whole commander-in-chief, 3 a.m. phone call. It's just like, it's a very gendered
office.
Well, I
don't even think it's that. I think it's that when women are running for Congress, you don't actually, like, see them that much. Like, women's, like, you don't actually see them on the stump, on your local news all that much. You're not interacting with a woman candidate and seeing her all the time, right? In the way that you are a presidential candidate. And I think it's less, in some ways, the job of president, although I think it's that people are annoyed by women standing up and saying stuff sometimes. And I think it's, so I think a lot of it isn't necessarily the presidency in particular. It is that voters are getting more exposure to women in a position of power, and they find it just kind of irritating in the same way that they would find it irritating at work or wherever. And so it's more exposure therapy gone wrong, in some sense, than like, although I do think it's also the job, but I think it's literally just people seeing the presidential candidates more and kind of being like, eh.
But I mean, both of those work together, right? Like, not only is the job have its own, like, gendered stuff, but as you say, like, tons of research and experience shows that people have this reaction when women are ambitious. What's more ambitious than running for the presidency, right?
Pope.
Well,
Pope,
I mean,
you could
I think
run
you
for
see
Pope,
that,
yeah.
I think you see that almost more in, like, coverage of, like, Warren's newly aggressive strategy towards Sanders. People are like, oh my gosh, you know, she can't have leaked these comments herself, right? She would never do that, right?
Right.
It's like, well, actually, you know,
she
just takes some risk, yeah. And she's a pretty savvy politician. But like, okay, look at that chart. Over the age of 70, Warren is 70, she doesn't fall in that bucket quite, right? You know, according to the polls, it's a much bigger deal for voters, as is socialist. Or is Bernie Sanders identified as an atheist? I guess not, right? But like those things, based on the polls, are like bigger deals than being a woman, right? Much, much, much bigger deals. And yet there's very little discussion about that. There was like kind of, you know, one news cycle about age around when Sanders actually had a heart attack, for God's sake, right? And the woman electable thing comes up again and again and again and again. And like, I don't know. I mean, are we doing our job correctly in the media by fixating on that? I'm not really sure.
That to me is actually a super interesting question. Because even if I'm super convinced that a woman running for president does face hurdles that men don't, and those hurdles are like, I don't think they're dispositive, right? Like, I think a woman can win. But let's say they're real major hurdles. What do you do with that? Like, what then do we do? Do we just say that and leave it be? Or if you just left it, if you left the primary process to run its course, would it just naturally find candidates who could overcome those hurdles anyway? If the electability conversation wasn't kind of f***ing it up, you know?
I mean, I'd be curious to see when we first really started using it, because I think the well is already poisoned, right? It's already going to be the metric by which everything is measured. Most people's conversations about politics are pretty glib, right? And so you use the buzzwords that you read about in, like, your one or two newspaper articles a day or what you see on TV, and it's about electability, so bam, it's all done. Like, we can't fix... I mean... To be the pessimist, like, we can't fix it this time. It is there. There's no way to walk it back.
I mean, do you think that people's perceptions of how other Americans, other voters view women are kind of shaping this all a little too much? I mean, if you look at the next chart on the screen behind me, it's people who say they're ready to vote for a woman for president versus people's perceptions of whether or not Americans are ready to vote for a woman for president. And as you can see, a lot more people say that they're ready to vote for a woman for president than they think when they're asked to speculate about the rest of the country.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of the screwed up side effects of a super partisan country, is that you think everyone on the other side lives in a completely different world than you do. And they don't necessarily when it comes to voting for a woman. But that, I think that's a side effect of partisanship.
No, but yeah, and the other thing is, like, pundits make bad pundits. Everyday people make terrible pundits. So, like, there's I think, I don't know if we have it actually, but one polling firm asked this question, like, okay, who do you support for presidency? And then they asked, okay, if you could just wave a magic wand.
Do have it.
Perfect. Okay, if you could wave a magic wand to make anyone president, who would you support? And what you see is Warren's support goes up like a ton under the magic wand scenario, right? And I think what that shows is that, at least to some extent, people's perceptions of how these electability conversations are affecting things and who's electable and who's not are miscalibrated or, at the very least, self-fulfilling, right? It's one or the other.
I mean, I also saw some day-to-day where if you ask a battery of questions about try to get at whether the voter himself or I suppose herself is sexist.
Women are sexist too.
Yeah.
Yeah. If you look at voters who score very low on that index, then basically the Democratic primary is that Biden and Warren are tied, and then kind of this is back when Kamala Harris was in the race, right? And then Bernie and Harris are like tied for third and then whatever else, right? When you look at the whole electorate, then you kind of wind up more where you wind up, right? Where it's Biden gains, all the men gain ground. Biden, Bernie gain ground, and Harris and Warren lose ground.
I do also think, I mean, just to, the reason why I think the common sense argument about this, all of this, going back to the original thing, is so important is because I do think it makes a really big difference that Hillary Clinton was the first nominee because she was historically disliked, as was Donald Trump, right? And so the fact that it was almost this, I mean, you know, the confluence of history got her to this point, but it also got her to be a really divisive figure in American life. So I could also think, you know, maybe women are pretty electable, actually, on lower levels in office could maybe be true if a different person had been the first female nominee, right? If there wasn't this kind of hangover of, well, people didn't vote for Clinton because they're sexist. Definitely. But also some people would say, well, I'm not sexist. I just didn't like Hillary Clinton for the reasons of 20 years of kind of sexist media coverage, probably.
And well, so that's kind of theory,
so it's,
right?
So it's all kind of like, I do think Clinton herself having been the nominee has redounding effects that are negative for women who try to run like this cycle, basically.
Absolutely. But I do think, like, you wonder, I mean, Claire and I were actually talking about this earlier, but, like, we went to the Republican convention in 2016, and you could not go and walk through the streets around there and see the T-shirts that people were selling, the mugs people were selling, and not think that gender was playing a huge role.
Super vulgar stuff, yeah.
Very vulgar stuff, very gendered stuff. You could not see that stuff and come away. Gender played a huge role, I think, in the dislike of Clinton. Or in the hate of Clinton, I should say, really. Like, you could dislike Clinton and not vote for her, but there was, like, real hatred for Clinton. And so I do wonder, like, if the Democratic nominee in 2020 is a woman, I think it's a fairly safe bet that you would see a lot of that same stuff. But then again, kind of what do we do with that fact? Like, in some ways, I think Sanders, you know, supposing he said this, right? It's not so much that he said it. I mean, you're saying, I think we're all saying kind of the same thing. It's more that he said it to Warren, who was thinking about running for president. That's the problem, right?
Well, I don't know. Like, they're two, as Nate said, they're two politicians. They're having a frank discussion about running for to compete for similar voters.
Yeah.
I haven't done any reporting around this, but, like, I do believe that they kind of both probably believe their versions of it.
Yeah.
I think maybe Sanders could have been a little more frank about saying, like, if this is what happened, yeah, I expressed that I do think it will be difficult to win as a woman this time around, right? I'm sure he expressed that in some way, in part because a lot of people express that. I mean, that is the perhaps most common conversation I have with voters and in, like, just talking to friends, right? Is that conversation. So, like, of course he said that. Now, I could also think if I am a woman about to announce a run for the presidency, that I would take it rather personally.
I mean, that kind of seems to be almost leaning in to his version of the story, right? Like, you can imagine him saying something that is like, you know, it's so hard for a woman or something like that, right? That seems like a little bit more actually explaining the difference between his account and her account, and also especially men, especially older men, often think they say things that are quite clever, especially around issues of race and gender, that are totally tin-eared to someone who is a woman or a person of color or is a little bit more versed in the language around it.
But he also might be right. Like, if we're going down to certain states where you have to win, I bet Sanders maybe, I don't know if he made, here's the argument you can make. Biden and Sanders, while having divergent policy positions, appeal to similar demographics. Why? In part, I think it's because they both kind of, you know, their identity is basically white working class, even though they're both millionaires, right? It's because they have built, you know, the Scranton Joe brand, the Bernie socialist union brand, right? Those things are really strong. They're male identifying. They both, frankly, are not polished is the wrong word, because actually, for all the shit that Joe Biden gets, he's actually, like, he's a good thinker, right? He's actually pretty good on the stump. Sanders is the same way, but they both say things. Like, when I was in Iowa last weekend, a woman stood up and was, Sanders has this portion of his stump speech where he basically asks for testimonials about people's health care. And this woman stands up and she says, I'm a single mom, blah, blah, blah. And Sanders said, you look like you're middle or lower middle class. And I was just like, and you know, you can, you know, it doesn't get covered or whatever, because people are just like, yeah, it's like how Bernie talks. But I mean, like, but he speaks off the cuff in this way that I think certain people appreciate and identify as authentic, whatever that means. Because let me tell you, like, all politicians, yeah. But
let's suppose he was trying to behave a little bit strategically. He's also a good politician, by the way. And he was trying to plant a seed of doubt in Warren's head about whether she was a viable nominee.
Oh my God, that's such a good play.
So I think now that it's out there and these two candidates are having this conversation, we just had the kind of genuine part of that conversation. From a political strategic point of view, how does that shake out? Like, are Warren or Sanders benefiting at all from having this conversation in public? Is it benefiting Joe Biden? Is it benefiting Pete Buttigieg?
Yes. But it's also, I mean, I think we had our tracking poll with Ipsos that went up the day after the debate. People liked Warren's performance, right? She bumped up like four.
They did. They liked her performance. She increased her standing across all the metrics that we tracked, including electability. Sanders' favorability rating fell a little bit in that poll. You know, my thing is, if you kind of, electability is a big consideration for voters, whether you foreground it or not, right? Maybe by foregrounding it, then you allow voters to think through it in a way that's arguably a bit more rational.
What do you mean when you say foregrounding it?
By making people think about it explicitly, yeah. Right? Instead of relying, I mean, this is about like...
spelling out the term.
Perceived versus actual electability versus kind of animal instinct electability versus like weaponized electability or whatever else, right? But like, if you make voters say, okay, first of all...
animal instinct, the 2020 story.
Animal
no, if they say, okay,
yeah, that's good.
Maybe the thing I can't put in my finger about Warren is that, oh, I'm bothered that she is a woman, and maybe I'm not comfortable with that, right? Maybe as a woman especially, I do not want to let these sexist presumptions about who is electable color who I'm going to vote for.
It's also with Warren, it's tied up in, I mean, I kind of wrote a piece about this that went up today that was a bit hot tip, guys. It's sort of like the idea that Warren is still a Democrat and Sanders still identifies as outside of the Democratic caucus, right? He is an independent. She is the kind of more establishment pick, right? Like she's a little more like speaks the language of, and we're going to do this and this and this. And like, you know, she supported Hillary Clinton. Like there is some of it where it's also tied up in like the insider-outsider paradigm that's going on in politics. So I don't think it's all about gender. I think a lot of it is also about people wanting the, we're going to kick the door in, or, you know, Warren is a little more, she's behind the door, but like kind of close to it, to torture the metaphor.
In your article today, one of my favorite lines was, you know, they're both progressives, they're both populists. Elizabeth Warren recognizes that there are people who agree with the intellectual argument who are still comfortable in the current system, right?
Yeah.
And so she's making the argument to, you know, people who are upper middle class, who have benefited in the system, who like the intellectual argument and maybe don't want to kick the door down because they're comfortable.
Sure, right? I mean, it's like, that's what's so interesting actually to me about, like, let's say a room like this, right? Which is, I'm going to make an educated guess, that a lot of you are well-educated, and also a lot of you are probably in well-paying jobs and benefit from the system, right? And yet, from the claps, you support Elizabeth Warren. I mean, just thinking through why, a lot of it is, I'm sure, the way her rhetoric presents populism, and it is populism, the way it presents progressivism, is couched in terms that people like you like. Sorry to call you out, but like, I also live in a city and like went to college and am white, right? So that's a Warren voter, right? Like demographically, that's a Warren voter. But I do think that the way she, so this is my argument, is that the Warren-Sanders progressivism fight isn't about policy difference. It's about rhetoric. It's about self-presentation. And I got some emails today, which I take, which were from left activists saying, no, it's more about the relationships to the party organs, to the party establishments. And that's all true. But it is all caught up in essentially like populism that appeals to the elites, who frankly, white college-educated voters are a really important demographic for Democrats to have. Urban voters, they need to run up the margins in cities. But it is also like an interesting, frankly, like, class and sociological thing that's going on right now in America is the selling of populism.
There is one more dimension of this whole Sanders-Warren conflict that I think has been underplayed, which is that Sanders kind of has two modes, right? There is one mode in which you can say, let's all get unified. We're all part of the Democratic Party. We believe in social justice and economic justice, right? I know literally like in the Bernie is back rally, he's like, go find the person next to you at the rally and like, talk to them and give them a pat in the back or whatever, right? And so especially post-hard tech, he's had a more unifying message. But there are also elements of the Sanders candidacy and campaign that are very not unifying, right? Where certainly his campaign staff and sometimes his supporters can spark a lot of conflict, right? Maybe you're someone who is pretty well off, but you feel like, I want the country to move to the left, right? He kind of has ambiguous feelings toward you. So, you know, you could say that Warren wanted to bring out those more antagonistic elements of the Sanders campaign, and maybe Sanders himself, which are associated with the Bernie we saw in the first half of the year that was kind of at 15% and did seem to have more of a ceiling versus the new version of Bernie. It's 20% and higher favorability ratings.
Yeah, I actually don't have like a really strong sense for now that this debate is sort of dominating the news cycle, who benefits. But I think that is a good way to think about it, of like, okay, does foregrounding the conversation help Warren by some voters kind of reevaluating their thinking, but also just by like kind of inherently in this setup, Sanders is on the like anti-woman isn't the right thing, but sort of like he's just like the way it's framed, he's sort of like making this case. I understand he's like not, he's describing the world as he sees it. But the counterpoint to that is that I think what Nate's getting at, which is like, you know, the PC political correctness has run amok crowd is not just in the Republican Party. That's in the Democratic Party too. Yeah. I think you see a lot of that in a lot of Sanders supporters. And so do those feelings kind of rise up?
Because he could have reacted differently. I mean, he could have said from the get-go, like, look, here's what I said. I understand it's a conversation with two friends. I'm so sorry if my friend misunderstood. Of course, a woman is electable, right? And instead, his campaign had rapid response. It was like, this is unsourced, and you can't believe it. These are lies. Can't possibly be true, right? That seemed like a fairly big, unforced error, given that, like, you know, you have to know that, like, at the very least, these are people close to Warren who had heard Warren say it, and, like, yeah. All she has to do is like say, okay, yeah, he said it.
It is understandable, though, from the Sanders campaign point of view, because they're defensive about their views on gender. And I would also say that like a lot of female Sanders voters would say, my identity doesn't have to determine who I vote for. And actually, you heard a lot of that in 08 in the Democratic primary, especially with younger women, right, who, and in 16, remember Gloria Steinem had that kind of cringeworthy thing of, you know, girls just want to vote for who their boyfriend is voting for, right? I think some of that generational tension is there too. So, but I think, yeah, I mean, the Sanders campaign, I think, is was so used to being in a defensive crouch because of 16 that they perhaps sometimes strategically react in ways that aren't. Galen, what's your dad's great phrase?
Oh, measure your response by how it serves your goal, not by how it serves your fury.
Yes.
Thanks, Dad.
Yeah, which is like one of my favorite things. It's a person with a temper.
Yeah, I was going to say.
But I think that sometimes that is kind of like the Sanders campaign problem.
Yeah. And I will say, you put that in one of your pieces one time, and I think it was like my dad's proudest moment.
I credited him, right? Didn't I?
I think you just said like a friend's dad,
yeah.
Which I appreciated. He didn't need to be that identified. All right, anyway, of course, this is a complicated conversation, something we'll continue talking about over the coming months, and we'll actually watch play out before our eyes in the run-up to the Iowa caucus. So, thank you for having that conversation, and now we're going to play a game. Yay. Our game is called Guess What Americans Think. But first, today's podcast is brought to you by Upstart. Between hitting the gym, eating healthier, or learning a new skill, there are lots of ways we can better ourselves in the new year. One way is by tackling high-interest credit card debt, and Upstart.com can help. Upstart is the revolutionary lending platform that offers smarter rates to help pay off high-interest credit card debt. Upstart goes beyond the traditional credit score when assessing your credit worthiness. They actually reward you based on your education and job history in the form of a smarter rate. Upstart believes you're more than your credit score. Over 400,000 people have used Upstart to pay off credit cards and meet their financial goals. See why Upstart is ranked number one in their category with over 300 businesses on Trustpilot, and hurry to upstart.com/politics to find out how low your Upstart rate is. Checking your rate only takes a few minutes. That's upstart.com/politics.
Yay. For the record, while Galen was reading the ad, Nate took out his phone to, he said, check for new polls.
That's true.
It's very stereotypical. I thought you would, you know.
Our final segment for this evening, before listener questions, of course, we're going to play Guess What Americans Think, and it works exactly how it sounds. I'm going to bring up a certain topic, and Nate, Claire, and Micah have to guess how Americans feel about it according to the polls. Whoever gets the closest wins. Ready?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. What percent of Americans support having an upper age limit for serving as president? Nate, you're first.
We need to go freestyle? We don't get any hints?
Oh, no hints.
Okay.
36%.
Claire?
25.
I'll say 24.
And Nate has it.
Wow.
41%.
Yeah, I guess if you're going to drag off of someone, it should be Nate.
That's crazy, though.
And so for a little context, just some fun facts, the minimum age for being president of the Republic in Italy is 50. It's like pretty old. In France, it's 18. I could not find any countries that had an age maximum.
Yeah, but this is just an example of, like, kind of how Americans are full of shit. Like, no. You see all these polls. That's a huge chunk of the country, right? 41%. And lots of polls show Democrats don't want to vote for someone over the age of, you know,
70.
Whatever, 70, 65. And yet Biden is leading in every poll, and number two is Bernie, and number
and Trump
is Warren.
President.
Yeah, and Trump is president.
Yeah. All right. So, next
polls,
question
man, polls,
begins.
You know, it's like our whole thing, too. Yeah.
Nate has 1-0. Claire, you start off the next one. What percent of Americans support making D.C. a state? Whoa. I'll give you a hint. It's not represented
yeah,
by this crowd.
I'm going to go like 52.
52. Micah?
God, we can hear you guessing, guys. I'm going to say it's like 27.
I was going with like the partisan split kind of. I don't know.
53.
Micah has it. It's 29%. Ooh.
Wait, oh, I thought you were booing me winning for a second.
No. So, for some context, in 2016, 86% of D.C. residents voted in support of statehood in a referendum. So clearly they want to be a state, but America doesn't want you.
You got to earn it, people.
You got to work a little harder. All right.
In fairness, I should say, somebody in the crowd said 30%, which is why I guessed where I did. So the crowd gets 1 point.
Are you giving that point away?
Yeah. No, we'll share it.
Okay. 1-0, half. Okay. What percent of Americans support making Puerto Rico a state? Starting with you, Micah.
Oh, me.
It's you.
This is going to be, yeah, I'll say 14%.
14%, Nate?
50.
Claire?
51.
And Claire gets it. 66% of Americans support making Puerto Rico a state.
Wow.
Because that seems more like it would track along like partisan divide stuff.
It's in the
whereas
Republican
no, whereas
platform.
No one gives...
Oh, I see. Okay.
No one really cares about D.C.
Yeah, D.C., you guys are...
There's bipartisan support for Puerto Rican statehood.
It's because, I mean, frankly, it's because people hate D.C. As a concept, and people love Puerto Rico as a concept. No, I'm serious.
Oh, wait, we have people in the audience agreeing, shaking their heads yes. Claire speaks the truth. So it's 1-1-1, or like 1-1-half.
No, we're sharing. 1-1-1.
All right, this one's for Nate, and you're also starting. So what percent of Americans think the lack of civility in politics is a serious problem?
I roll. 73.
Okay. Claire?
70.
74, yeah.
Micah gets it. 88% of Americans said it's a serious problem.
Nate? Tell us about how you think civility is a real problem in politics.
No, because then it's going to turn into like a whole monologue.
If you're longtime listeners of the podcast, know that Nate is not a fan of civility, for better or worse.
I just think it's the wrong vector to press on, right?
All right.
That was the most Nate thing I've ever heard.
We have like a feral podcast.
So it's 1-1-2. So Nate 1, Claire 1, Micah 2. Next up, we have... What percent of Americans think that marijuana should be made legal?
This is me?
Yes, Claire.
66.
Yeah. I think it's probably up to like, I'll go higher, a little higher, 71.
420? No, I'm sorry.
Take them anywhere.
65.
It's, 65.
It's, yeah, you guys are overestimating a bit.
Claire gets it exactly.
Oh!
And for a little context here, this is an all-time high. In 2011, it was at 50% support. In 2003, it was at 34%. All the way back in 1969, it was at 12%. So there you go. People change their minds.
America goes up in smoke.
America.
By the way, this is why marijuana isn't legal. It's because the press can't cover it without just making pot jokes.
A fun fact, in the New York Media League, High Times is like really good at softball, like super good.
Yeah.
Ooh, hot tip.
Yeah.
All right, next one goes to you, Micah. What percent of Americans approve of the way President Trump is handling the economy?
47%.
47.
57%.
52.
And Nate gets it to a T. 57%. So that is also the highest it's been. This is just from January 12th was when this poll ended, 2020. That's the highest it's been since Quinnipiac began asking the question when Trump took office. The lowest point was 39% in June of 2017. All right. So it's actually Nate has 2, Claire has 2, and Micah has 2. So I guess this is our final question, and this is going to determine who wins. So... What is the most popular sandwich in America?
BLT.
PBJ.
Okay, so PBJ.
BLT.
Don't help him. Don't help him. Don't help him.
Hot dog does not qualify as a sandwich.
We're not getting into that debate.
I'm going to say, see, those are both really good guesses. I'm going to say...
Do you need PBJ still?
No. Should I try to block one of them, actually?
I don't know, but you should pick something.
What's the third most popular
I don't know.
Sandwich?
Go with turkey, man.
Yeah, I'll say turkey.
Turkey. Oh,
that's not right. That's not right. Okay. Okay. I'm going to go with a... There's not another recognizable sandwich. I'll say a grilled cheese.
Okay, so just to review. Nate, you said?
PB&J.
Claire, you said?
BLT, but that might just be mine.
And Micah, you're going with grilled cheese.
Yeah, but I think Claire's right.
And grilled cheese wins it.
I would like to thank the audience for giving me all the answers.
So you all weren't, I guess, that far off. So this is based on YouGov data. 79% of Americans support a grilled cheese sandwich. So then the order goes like this. And there's not a lot of differentiation up at the top. Then it goes grilled chicken, then turkey, then roast beef, then ham, then BLT, Claire, is at 69%. Club, then bacon, then PBJ is at 66%.
I mean, they're British.
Wait a second.
I'm not really sure they're qualified to opine on American food.
They were asking Americans, though.
Yeah, it's
not... Like, where's a banh mi sandwich?
Was it an open-ended question or multiple choice?
I think it just gave them all the sandwiches, and they had to choose which ones they supported.
And first of all, a hamburger clearly is a sandwich, isn't it?
Oh, my God.
All right, so before this goes off the rails...
Well, like, one of the answers was, like, ham. Ham is a meat.
A ham sandwich.
A ham sandwich?
I told... By the way, technically, two of mine were in, like, the top six. I said turkey as a suggestion to you.
Yeah. Did the person who shouted out grilled cheese over here know the answer?
No.
Oh, it was a real guess?
We love grilled cheese.
Amen. Yeah, get it. Okay, all right, that's a wrap for today's podcast. Thank you, Nate. Thank you, Claire.
Thanks, Galen.
Thank you, Micah. And thank you to everybody at Sixth and I for hosting us. We really appreciate it. And a special thanks to Vanessa Diaz, who took the lead on organizing tonight's show. And, of course, thanks to all of you in the audience. Again, give yourselves a round of applause. I'll note, we have a live show coming up in Manchester, New Hampshire, the Sunday before the primary there, so look for details on that. We'll also tweet out a link to tickets. It'll be fun, lots of suspense. You can get in touch by emailing us at podcasts@538.com. You can also, of course, tweet at us with any questions or comments. If you're a fan of the show, leave us a rating or a review in the Apple Podcast Store, or tell someone about the show, tell your friends. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you soon.